This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Nemesis, by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1989 by Nightfall Incorporated. All rights reserved. Narrated by Fred Major. This book contains 364 pages on 9 sides.
If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Annotation. AD 2236. The star Nemesis, with its own planetary system that includes Rotor, home to a renegade Earth colony, is on a collision course with Earth. A young Rotorian girl is trying to warn Earth of the impending destruction. When she discovers that her own planet is also in danger from Nemesis, she must try to save both planets. 1989. From the book jacket. For close to 40 years, Isaac Asimov has thrilled millions of readers worldwide with his renowned science fiction series, Foundation, Robot, and Empire. Now, in a major publishing event, the grandmaster of science fiction brings to life his first new world in nearly 2 decades, Nemesis. AD 2236, Earth and its 100 space colonies are crowded, anarchical, socially degenerate. Some 2 light years distant, hidden in a corner of the galaxy, burns a star that neighbors Earth's sun, a star that supports its own burgeoning planetary system. Megas, Erythro, and Rotor, a renegade Earth colony. The star is named Nemesis. When Nemesis was discovered, it was seen as the last hope for the human race, a starting over point for a brave band of adventurers led by the brilliant, if megalomaniac, Commissioner Janus Pitt on Rotor. Pitt and his loyal followers had secretly detached themselves from Earth's orbit and traveled via superluminal flight to the Nemetic system to establish a new utopia, a society stronger, purer, and ultimately superior to the one left behind. Now, however, a 15-year-old Rotorian girl has learned of the subtle yet dire threat that Nemesis poses to Earth and its people. But she is prevented from warning them, for Pitt has dedicated his life to ensuring that his new civilization will be the supreme power of the galaxy, no matter what the cost. And he will not let anything, or anyone, stand in his way. But as Marlena digs deeper, she discovers that Nemesis threatens not only Earth, but Rotor as well. And now it is up to her to save both Earth and Rotor, as drawn inexorably by Nemesis, the Death Star, they hurtle toward sure disaster. About the author. Isaac Asimov is America's most prolific author, with over 400 books to his credit. His essay collections, mystery stories, and science fiction, including the hugely successful Foundation series, are known and loved the world over. He lives and writes in New York City. Other fiction by Isaac Asimov. Norby Down to Earth, 1988, with Janet Asimov. Azazel, 1988. Prelude to Foundation, 1988. Other Universes of Isaac Asimov, 1987. Norby Finds a Villain, 1987, with Janet Asimov. Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, 1987. Norby and the Queen's Necklace, 1986, with Janet Asimov. Robot Dreams, 1986. Foundation and Earth, 1986. The Best Science Fiction of Isaac Asimov, 1986. The Best Mysteries of Isaac Asimov, 1986. Science Fiction by Asimov, 1986. The Alternate Asimovs, 1986. Norby and the Invaders, 1985, with Janet Asimov. It's Such a Beautiful Day, 1985. Robots and Empire, 1985. The Disappearing Man and Other Mysteries, 1985. The Edge of Tomorrow, 1985. Norby and the Lost Princess, 1985, with Janet Asimov. Banquets of the Black Widowers, 1984. Norby's Other Secret, 1984, with Janet Asimov. The Robots of Dawn, 1983. Norby, the Mixed-Up Robot, 1983, with Janet Asimov. The Union Club Mysteries, 1983. The Winds of Change and Other Stories, 1983. Foundation's Edge, 1982. The Complete Robot, 1982. The Casebook of the Black Widowers, 1980. The Key Word and Other Mysteries, 1977. More Tales of the Black Widowers, 1976. The Bicentennial Man and Other Stories, 1976. Good Taste, 1976. Murder at the ABA, 1976. The Heavenly Host, 1975. By Jupiter and Other Stories, 1975. Tales of the Black Widowers, 1974. Have you seen these? 1974. The Best of Isaac Asimov, 1973. The Early Asimov, 1972. The Gods Themselves, 1972. The Best New Thing, 1971. Nightfall and Other Stories, 1969. Asimov's Mysteries, 1968. Through a Glass Clearly, 1967. Fantastic Voyage, 1966. The Rest of the Robots, 1964. Nine Tomorrows, 1959. The Death Dealers, A Whiff of Death, 1958. Lucky Star and the Rings of Saturn, 1958. Earth is Room Enough, 1957. Lucky Star and the Moons of Jupiter, 1957. The Naked Sun, 1957. Lucky Star and the Big Sun of Mercury, 1956. The End of Eternity, 1955. The Martian Way and Other Stories, 1955. Lucky Star and the Oceans of Venus, 1954. The Caves of Steel, 1954. Lucky Star and the Pirates of the Asteroids, 1953. Second Foundation, 1953. The Currents of Space, 1952. Foundation and Empire, 1952. David Starr, Space Ranger, 1952. Foundation, 1951. The Stars, Like Dust, 1951. I, Robot, 1950. Pebble in the Sky, 1950. To Mark Hurst, my valued copy editor, who, I think, works over my manuscripts harder than I do. Table of Contents.
Prologue, Side 1. Chapter 1, Marlena, Side 1. Chapter 2, Nemesis, Side 1. Chapter 3, Mother, Side 1. Chapter 4, Father, Side 1. Chapter 5, Gift, Side 2. Chapter 6, Approach, Side 2. Chapter 7, Destruction, Side 2. Chapter 8, Agent, Side 2. Chapter 9, Erythro, Side 2. Chapter 10, Persuasion, Side 3. Chapter 11, Orbit, Side 3. Chapter 12, Anger, Side 3. Chapter 13, Dome, Side 3. Chapter 14, Fishing, Side 3. Chapter 15, Plague, Side 4. Chapter 16, Hyperspace, Side 4. Chapter 17, Safe, Side 4. Chapter 18, Superluminal, Side 4. Chapter 19, Remaining, Side 5. Chapter 20, Proof, Side 5. Chapter 21, Brain Scan, Side 5. Chapter 22, Asteroid, Side 5. Chapter 23, Air Flight, Side 5. Chapter 24, Detector, Side 6. Chapter 25, Surface, Side 6. Chapter 26, Planet, Side 6. Chapter 27, Life, Side 6. Chapter 28, Takeoff, Side 7. Chapter 29, Enemy, Side 7. Chapter 30, Transition, Side 7. Chapter 31, Name, Side 7. Chapter 32, Lost, Side 8. Chapter 33, Mind, Side 8. Chapter 34, Close, Side 8. Chapter 35, Converging, Side 8. Chapter 36, Meeting, Side 9. Epilogue, Side 9. Author's Note. This book is not part of the Foundation series, the Robot series, or the Empire series. It stands independently. I just thought I'd warn you of that to avoid misapprehension. Of course, I might someday write another novel, tying this one to the others, but then again, I might not. After all, for how long can I keep flogging my mind to make it work out these complexities of future history? Another point. I made up my mind long ago to follow one cardinal rule in all my writing. To be clear. I have given up all thought of writing poetically or symbolically or experimentally or in any of the other modes that might, if I were good enough, get me a Pulitzer Prize. I would write merely clearly and in this way establish a warm relationship between myself and my readers and the professional critics. Well, they can do whatever they wish. However, my stories write themselves, I'm afraid, and in this one, I was rather appalled to find out that I was writing it in two strands. One set of events was taking place in the story's present, and another set was taking place in the story's past, but steadily approaching the present. I am sure you will have no trouble following the pattern, but since we are all friends, I thought I would let you know. Prologue. He sat there, alone and closed. Outside were the stars, and one particular star with its small system of worlds. He could see it in his mind's eye more clearly than he would see it in reality if he merely de-opacified the window. A small star, pinkish red, the color of blood and destruction, and named appropriately. Nemesis. Nemesis, the goddess of divine retribution. He thought again of the story he had once heard when he was young, a legend, a myth, a tale of a worldwide deluge that wiped out a sinful, degenerate humanity, leaving one family with which to start anew. No flood this time, just Nemesis. The degeneration of humanity had returned, and the Nemesis that would be visited upon it was an appropriate judgment. It would not be a deluge. Nothing as simple as a deluge. Even for the remnant who might escape, where would they go? Why was it he felt no sorrow? Humanity could not continue as it was. It was dying slowly through its own misdeeds. If it exchanged a slow, excruciating death for a much faster one, was that a cause for sorrow? Here, actually circling Nemesis, a planet. Circling the planet, a satellite. Circling the satellite, rotor. That ancient deluge carried a few to safety in an ark. He had only the vaguest idea of what the ark was, but rotor was its equivalent. It carried a sampling of humanity who would remain safe and from which a new and far better world would be built. But for the old world, there would be only Nemesis. He thought of it again, a red dwarf star moving on its inexorable path. Itself and its worlds were safe. Not so Earth. Nemesis was on its way, Earth, wreaking its divine retribution. Chapter 1. Marlena. 1. Marlena had last seen the solar system when she was a little over 1 year old. She didn't remember it, of course. She had read a great deal about it, but none of the reading had ever made her feel that it could ever have been part of her, nor she a part of it. In all her 15 years of life, she remembered only rotor. She had always thought of it as a large world. It was 8 kilometers across, after all. Every once in a while, since she was 10, once a month when she could manage it, she had walked around it for the exercise and sometimes had taken the low-gravity paths so she could skim a little. That was always fun. Skim or walk, rotor went on and on, with its buildings, its parks, its farms, and mostly its people. It took her a whole day to do it, but her mother didn't mind. She said rotor was perfectly safe. Not like Earth, she would say. But she wouldn't say why Earth was not safe. Never mind, she would say. It was the people Marlena liked least. The new census, they said, would show 60,000 of them on rotor. Too many. Far too many. Every one of them showing a false face.
Marlena hated seeing those false faces and knowing there was something different inside, nor could she say anything about it. She had tried sometimes when she had been younger, but her mother had grown angry and told her she must never say things like that. As she got older, she could see the falseness more clearly, but it bothered her less. She had learned to take it for granted and spend as much time as possible with herself and her own thoughts. Lately, her thoughts were often on Erythro, the planet they had been orbiting almost all her life. She didn't know why these thoughts were coming to her, but she would skim to the observation deck at odd hours and just stare at the planet hungrily, wanting to be there, right there on Erythro. Her mother would ask her impatiently why she would want to be on an empty, barren planet, but she never had an answer for that. She didn't know. "I just want to," she would say. She was watching it now, alone on the observation deck. Rotorians hardly ever came here. They had seen it all, Marlena guessed, and for some reason they didn't have her interest in Erythro. There it was, partly in light, partly dark. She had a dim memory of being held to watch it swim into view, seeing it every once in a while, always larger, as Rotor slowly approached all those years ago. Was it a real memory? After all, she had been getting on toward four then, so it might be. But now, that memory, real or not, was overlaid by other thoughts, by an increasing realization of just how large a planet was. Erythro was over 12,000 kilometers across, not 8 kilometers. She couldn't grasp that size. It didn't look that large on the screen, and she couldn't imagine standing on it and seeing for hundreds or even thousands of kilometers. But she knew she wanted to. Very much. Orinel wasn't interested in Erythro, which was disappointing. He said he had other things to think of, like getting ready for college. He was 17 and a half. Marlena was only just past 15. That didn't make much difference, she thought rebelliously, since girls developed more quickly. At least they should. She looked down at herself and thought, with her usual dismay and disappointment, that somehow she still looked like a kid, short and stubby. She looked at Erythro again, large and beautiful and softly red where it was lit. It was large enough to be a planet, but actually, she knew, it was a satellite. It circled Megas, and it was Megas, much larger still, that was really the planet, even though everyone called Erythro by that name. The two of them together, Megas and Erythro, and Rotor, too, circled the star Nemesis. Marlena? Marlena heard the voice behind her and knew that it was Orinel. She had grown increasingly tongue-tied with him of late, and the reason for it embarrassed her. She loved the way he pronounced her name. He pronounced it correctly. Three syllables, Marlena, with a little trill to the R. It warmed her just to hear it. She turned and mumbled, "Hi, Orinel," and tried not to turn red. He grinned at her. "You're staring at Erythro, aren't you?" She didn't answer that. Of course that's what she would be doing. Everyone knew how she felt about Erythro. "How come you're here?" "Tell me you were looking for me," she thought. Orinel said, "Your mother sent me." "Oh, well. Why?" "She said you were in a bad mood, and every time you felt sorry for yourself, you came up here, and I was to come and get you because she said it would just make you grumpier to stay here. So why are you in a bad mood?" "I'm not. And if I am, I have reasons." "What reasons?" "Come on now. You're not a little kid anymore. You've got to be able to express yourself." Marlena lifted her eyebrows. "I am quite articulate, thank you. My reasons are that I would like to travel." Orinel laughed. "You've traveled, Marlena. You've traveled more than 2 light years. No one in the whole history of the solar system has ever traveled even a small fraction of a light year, except us. So you have no right to complain. You're Marlena Insignia Fisher, galactic traveler." Marlena suppressed a giggle. Insignia was her mother's maiden name, and whenever Orinel said her three names in full, he would salute and make a face, and he hadn't done that in a long time. She guessed it was because he was getting close to being a grown-up, and he had to practice being dignified. She said, "I can't remember that trip at all. You know I can't, and not being able to remember it means it doesn't matter. We're just here, over 2 light years from the solar system, and we're never going back." "How do you know?" "Come on, Orinel. Do you ever hear anyone talk about going back?" "Well, even if we don't, who cares? Earth is a crowded world, and the whole solar system was getting crowded and used up. We're better off out here, masters of all we survey." "No, we're not. We survey Erythro. But we don't go down there to be its masters. Sure we do. We have a fine working dome on Erythro. You know that. Not for us. Just for some scientists. I'm talking about us. They don't let us go down there. In time, said Oranel cheerfully. Sure, when I'm an old woman. Or dead. Things aren't that bad. Anyway, come on out of here and into the world and make your mother happy. I can't stay here. I have things to do. Dolorette... Marlena felt a buzzing in her ears, and she didn't hear exactly what Oranel said after that. It was enough to hear Dolorette. Marlena hated Dolorette, who was tall and vacuous. But what was the use? Oranel had been hanging around her, and Marlena knew just by looking at him exactly how he felt about Dolorette. And now he had been sent to find her, and he was just wasting his time. She could tell that was how he felt, and she could also tell how anxious he was to get back to that Dolorette. Why could she always tell? It was so hateful sometimes. Quite suddenly, Marlena wanted to hurt him, to find words to give him pain. True words, though. She wouldn't lie to him. She said, "We're never going back to the solar system. I know why not." "Oh, why's that?" When Marlena, hesitating, said nothing, he added, "Mysteries?" Marlena was caught. She was not supposed to say this. She mumbled, "I don't want to say. I'm not supposed to know." But she did want to say. At the moment, she wanted everyone to feel bad. "But you'll tell me. We're friends, aren't we?" "Are we?" Marlena asked. She said, "Okay, I'll tell you. We're not ever going back because Earth is going to be destroyed." Oranel didn't react as she had expected. He burst into a loud squawk of a laugh. It took him a while to settle down, and she glared at him indignantly. "Marlena," he said, "where did you hear that? You've been viewing thrillers." "I have not." "But what makes you say anything like that?" "Because I know. I can tell. From what people say, but don't say, and what they do when they don't know they're doing it. And from things the computer tells me when I ask the right questions."
"Like what things it tells you?"
"I'm not going to tell you."
"Isn't it possible, just barely possible," and he held up two fingers very closely together, "that you're imagining things?"
"No, it isn't possible. Earth won't be destroyed right away, maybe not for thousands of years, but it's going to be destroyed."
She nodded solemnly, her face intense.
"And nothing can stop it."
Marlena turned and walked away, angry at Oranel for doubting her. No, not doubting her. It was more than that. He thought she was out of her mind. And there it was. She had said too much and had gained nothing by it. Everything was wrong. Oranel was staring after her. The laughter had ceased on his boyishly handsome face, and a certain uneasiness was creasing the skin between his eyebrows. Eugenia Insignia had grown middle-aged during the trip to Nemesis, and in the course of the long stay after arrival. Over the years, she had periodically warned herself, "This is for life and for our children's lives into the unseen future." The thought always weighed her down. Why? She had known this as the inevitable consequence of what they had done from the moment Rotor had left the solar system. Everyone on Rotor, volunteers all, had known it. Those who had not had the heart for eternal separation had left Rotor before takeoff. And among those who had left was... Eugenia did not finish that thought. It often came, and she tried never to finish it. Now they were here on Rotor, but was Rotor home? It was home for Marlena. She had never known anything else. But for herself, for Eugenia? Home was Earth, and Moon, and Sun, and Mars, and all the worlds that had accompanied humanity through its history and prehistory. They had accompanied life as long as there had been life. The thought that home was not here on Rota clung to her even now. But then, she had spent the first 28 years of her life in the solar system, and she had done graduate work on Earth itself in her 21st to 23rd years. Odd how the thought of Earth periodically came to her and lingered. She hadn't liked Earth. She hadn't liked its crowds, its poor organization, its combination of anarchy in the important things and governmental force in the little things. She hadn't liked its assaults of bad weather, its scars over the land, its wasteful ocean. She had returned to Rotor with an overwhelming gratitude and with a new husband to whom she had tried to sell her dear little turning world,
to make its orderly comfort as pleasant to him as it was to her, who had been born into it. But he had only been conscious of its smallness. "You run out of it in 6 months," he had said. She herself hadn't held his interest for much longer than that. Oh, well. It would work itself out. Not for her. Eugenia Insignia was lost forever between worlds, but for the children. Eugenia had been born to Rota and could live without Earth. Marlena had been born, or almost born, to Rota alone and could live without the solar system, except for the vague feeling that she had originated there. Her children would not know even that and would not care. To them, Earth and the solar system would be a matter of myth, and Erythro would have become a rapidly developing world. She hoped so. Marlena had this odd fixation on Erythro already, though it had only developed in the last few months and might leave just as quickly as it had come. Altogether, it would be the height of ingratitude to complain. No one could possibly have imagined a habitable world in orbit about Nemesis. The conditions that created habitability were remarkable. Estimate those probabilities and throw in the nearness of Nemesis to the solar system, and you would have to deny that it could possibly have happened. She turned to the day's reports, which the computer was waiting with the infinite patience of its tribe to give her. Yet before she could ask, her receptionist signaled and a soft voice came from the small button speaker pinned to the left shoulder of her garment. "Orinel Pampas wishes to see you. He has no appointment." Insignia grimaced, then remembered that she had sent him after Marlena. She said, "Let him come in." She cast a quick look at the mirror. She could see that her appearance was reasonable. To herself, she seemed to look younger than her 42 years. She hoped she looked the same way to others. It seemed silly to worry about her appearance because a 17-year-old boy was about to enter, but Eugenia Insignia had seen poor Marlena looking at that boy, and she knew what that look portended. It didn't seem to Insignia that Orinel, who was so fond of his own appearance, would ever think of Marlena, who had never been able to rid herself of her childhood pudginess, in any other way than as an amusing child. Still, if Marlena had to face failure in this, let her not feel that her mother had contributed to that failure in any way and had been anything but charming to the boy. "She'll blame me anyway," thought Insignia with a sigh, as the boy walked in with a smile that had not yet outgrown its adolescent shyness. "Well, Orinel," she said, "did you find Marlena?"
"Yes, ma'am.
Right where you said she'd be, and I told her you wanted her out of there."
"And how is she feeling?"
"If you want to know, Dr. Insignia, I can't tell if it's depression or something else, but she has a rather funny idea in her head. I don't know that she'd like my telling you about it."
"Well, I don't like setting spies on her either, but she frequently has strange ideas, and she worries me. Please tell me what she said."
Orinel shook his head.
"All right, but don't tell her I said anything. This one is really crazy. She said that Earth was going to be destroyed."
He waited for Insignia to laugh. She did not. Instead, she exploded.
"What? What made her say that?"
"I don't know, Dr. Insignia. She's a very bright kid, you know, but she gets these funny ideas. Or she may have been putting me on." Insignia cut in.
"She may have been doing exactly that. She has a strange sense of humor. So listen, I don't want you to repeat this to anyone else. I don't want silly stories to get started. Do you understand?"
"Certainly, ma'am."
"I'm serious. Not a word."
Orinel nodded briskly.
"But thanks for telling me, Orinel. It was important to do so. I'll speak to Marlena and find out what's bothering her. And I won't let her know you told me."
"Thank you," said Orinel.
"But just one thing, ma'am."
"What's that?"
"Is Earth going to be destroyed?"
Insignia stared at him, then forced a laugh.
"Of course not. You may go now."
Insignia looked after him and wished earnestly that she could have managed a more convincing denial. 3. Janus Pitt made an impressive appearance which had helped him in his rise to power as commissioner of Rota. In the early days of the formation of the settlements, there had been a push for people of no more than average height. There had been thoughts of having a smaller per capita requirement for room and resources. Eventually, the caution had been deemed unnecessary and had been abandoned. But the bias was still there in the genes of the early settlements, and the average Rotorian remained a centimeter or two shorter than the average citizens of later settlements. Pitt was tall, though,
with iron gray hair and a long face and deep blue eyes and a body that was still in good shape, despite the fact that he was 56. Pitt looked up and smiled as Eugenia Insignia entered, but felt the usual small surge of uneasiness. There was something always uneasy-making about Eugenia, even wearying. She had these causes, capital C, that were hard to deal with. "Thank you for seeing me, Janus," she said, "on such short notice." Pitt placed his computer on hold and leaned back in his chair, deliberately producing an air of relaxation. "Come," he said. "There's no formality between us. We go back a long way."
"And have shared a great deal," said Insignia.
"So we have," said Pitt. "And how is your daughter?"
"It's about her I wish to speak, as a matter of fact. Are we shielded?"
Pitt's eyebrows arched. "Why shielded? What is there to shield, and from whom?"
The very question activated Pitt's realization of the odd position in which Rota found itself. To all practical purposes, it was alone in the universe. The solar system was more than 2 light-years away, and no other intelligence-bearing worlds might exist within hundreds of light-years or, for all anyone knew, billions of light-years in any direction. Rotorians might have fits of loneliness and uncertainty, but they were free of any fear of outside interference. Well, almost any fear, thought Pitt. Insignia said, "You know what there is to shield. It was you who have always insisted on secrecy." Pitt activated the shield and said, "Are we to take that up again? Please, Eugenia, it's all settled. It was settled when we left 14 years ago. I know that you brood about it now and then."
"Brood about it? Why not? It's my star."
And her arm flailed outward as if in the direction of Nemesis.
"It's my responsibility."
Pitt's jaw tightened. "Do we have to go through all this again?" he thought. Aloud, he said, "We're shielded. Now, what's bothering you?"
"Marlena, my daughter. Somehow she knows."
"Knows what?"
"About Nemesis and the solar system."
"How could she know? Unless you've told her?"
Insignia spread her arms helplessly.
"Of course I didn't tell her, but I don't have to. I don't know how it is, but somehow Marlena seems to hear and see everything. And from the little things she hears and sees, she works things out. She's always been able to do it, but in the last year it's grown much worse."
"Well, then, she guesses, and sometimes she makes lucky guesses. Tell her she's wrong, and see that she doesn't talk about it."
"But she's already told a young man who came to tell me. That's how I know. Oronel Pampas. He's a friend of the family."
"Ah, yes. I'm aware of him. Somewhat. Simply tell him not to listen to fantasies made up by a little girl."
"She's not a little girl. She's 15.
"To him, she's a little girl, I assure you. I said I'm aware of the young man. I'm under the impression he's pushing adulthood very hard, and I remember when I was his age that 15-year-old girls were beneath contempt, especially if they were..."
Insignia said bitterly, "I understand. Especially if they are short, plump, and plain. Does it matter that she's highly intelligent?"
"To you and me? Certainly. To Oronel, certainly not. If necessary, I'll talk to the boy. You talk to Marlena. Tell her the idea is ridiculous, that it isn't true, and that she must not spread disturbing fairy tales."
"But what if it is true?"
"That's beside the point. Look, Eugenia, you and I have concealed this possibility for years, and it would be better if we continued to conceal it. If it gets around, it will be exaggerated, and there will be rising sentiment about the matter. Useless sentiment. It will only distract us from the job that has occupied our time ever since we left the solar system, and which will continue to occupy us for generations, perhaps." She looked at him, shocked, unbelieving.
"Have you really no feeling for the solar system, for Earth, the world on which humanity originated?"
"Yes, Eugenia. I have all sorts of feelings, but they're visceral, and I can't let them sway me. We left the solar system because we thought it was time for humanity to spread outward. Others, I'm sure, will follow. Maybe they are already doing so. We have made humanity a galactic phenomenon, and we mustn't think in terms of a single planetary system anymore. Our job is here." They stared at each other. Then Eugenia said with a touch of hopelessness,
"You'll talk me down again. You've talked me down for so many years."
"Yes. But next year I'll have to again. And the year after. You won't stay down, Eugenia, and you tire me. The first time should have been enough."
and he turned away, back to his computer. Chapter 2. Nemesis. 4. The first time he had talked her down had been 16 years ago, in the year 2220, that exciting year in which the possibilities of the galaxy had opened up for them. Janus Pitt's hair was a dark brown then, and he was not yet commissioner of Rota, though everyone spoke of him as the up-and-coming man. He did head the Department of Exploration and Commerce, however, and the far probe was his responsibility, and, to a large extent, the result of his actions. It was the first attempt to push matter through space with a hyper-assisted drive. As far as was known, only Rota had developed hyper-assistance, and Pitt had been the strongest proponent of secrecy. He had said at a meeting of the Council, "The solar system is crowded. There are more space settlements than can easily be found room for. Even the asteroid belt is only an amelioration. It will be uncomfortably crowded soon enough. What's more, each settlement has its own ecological balance, and we are drifting apart in that respect. Commerce is being throttled for fear of picking up someone else's strains of parasites or pathogens. The only solution, fellow counselors, is to leave the solar system without fanfare, without warning. Let us leave and find a new home where we can build a new world with our own brand of humanity, our own society, our own way of life. This can't be done without hyper-assistance, which we have. Other settlements will eventually learn the technique and will leave, too. The solar system will be a dandelion gone to seed, its various components drifting in space. But if we go first, we will find a world perhaps before others follow. We can establish ourselves firmly so that when others do follow and perhaps come across us in our new world, we will be strong enough to send them elsewhere. The galaxy is large, and there are bound to be elsewheres." There had been objections, of course, and fierce ones. There were those who argued out of fear of leaving the familiar. There were those who argued out of sentiment for the planet of birth. There were those who argued out of idealism, the desire to spread knowledge so that others might go too. Pitt had scarcely thought he would win out. He had done so because Eugenia Insigna had supplied the winning argument. What an incredible stroke of luck it was that she had come to him first. She was quite young then, only 26, married but not yet pregnant. She was excited, flushed, and laden down with computer sheets. Pitt had frowned, he recalled, at her intrusion. He was secretary of the department, and she... well, she was nobody, although, as it happened, this was the very last moment when she would be nobody. At the time, he didn't realize this, of course, and he was annoyed that she'd forced her way in. He cringed at the obvious excitement of the young woman. She was going to make him go through the infinite complexities of whatever it was she was holding in her hand and do so with an enthusiasm that would quickly exhaust him. She should give a brief summary to one of his assistants. He decided to say so. "I see you have data there, Dr. Insigna, that you wish to bring to my attention. I'll be glad to look at it in due course. Why don't you leave it with one of my people?" And he indicated the door, hoping ardently that she would about-face and move in that direction. Sometimes, in idle moments in later years, he would wonder what would have happened if she had, and his blood would run cold at the thought. But she said, No, Mr. Secretary, I must see you and no one else." Her voice trembled as she spoke, as though her inner excitement was unbearable. "It's the greatest discovery anyone has made since... She gave up. "It's the greatest." Pitt looked dubiously at the sheets she was holding. They were quivering, but he felt no answering excitement of his own. These specialists always thought that some micro-advance in their micro-field was system-shattering. He said, resigned, "Well, Doctor, can you explain it simply?"
"Are we shielded, sir?"
"Why do we have to be shielded?"
"I don't want anyone else to hear it till I'm sure. I have to check again and recheck till there's no doubt. But really, I have no doubt. I'm not making sense, am I?"
"No, you're not," said Pitt coldly, placing his hand on a contact. "We're shielded. Now tell me."
"It's all here. I'll show it to you."
"No. First tell me, in words, briefly." She drew a deep breath.
"Mr. Secretary, I've discovered the nearest star."
Her eyes were wide and she was breathing rapidly. Pitt said,
The nearest star is Alpha Centauri, and that's been known for 4 centuries.
It's the nearest star we've known, but it isn't the nearest star we can know. I have discovered one that is closer. The sun has a distant companion. Can you believe it?
Pitt considered her carefully. It was rather typical. If they were young enough, enthusiastic enough, inexperienced enough, they would explode prematurely every time. He said, "Are you sure?"
"I am. Really, let me show you the data. It's the most exciting thing that has happened in astronomy since..."
"If it's happened. And don't show me the data. I'll look at it later. Tell me, if there's a star much closer than Alpha Centauri, why hasn't it been discovered before now? Why was it left to you to do so, Dr. Insignia?" He knew he was sounding sarcastic, but she didn't seem to pay attention to his tone. She was far too excited.
"There's a reason. It's behind a cloud, a dark cloud, a puff of dust that just happens to be between the companion star and ourselves. Without the absorption of the dust, it would be an 1/8 magnitude star, and it would certainly have been noticed. The dust cuts down the light and makes it 1/19 magnitude, lost among many millions of other faint stars. There was no reason to notice it. No one looked at it. It's in Earth's far southern sky, so that most of the telescopes in pre-settlement days couldn't even point in that direction."
"And if so, how is it you've noticed it?"
"Because of the far probe. You see, this neighbor star and the sun are changing positions relative to each other, of course. I assume it and the sun are revolving about a mutual center of gravity very slowly in a period of millions of years. Some centuries ago, the positions may have been such that we could have seen the neighbor star to one side of the cloud in its full brightness, but we would still have needed a telescope to see it, and telescopes are only 6 centuries old. Less old than that in those places on Earth from which the neighbor star would be visible. Some centuries from now, it will be seen clearly again, shining from the other side of the dust cloud. But we don't have to wait for centuries. The far probe did it for us."
Pitt could feel himself igniting, a distant core of warmth arising within him. He said, "Do you mean that the far probe took a picture of that section of the sky containing this neighbor star, and that the far probe was far enough out in space to see around the cloud and detect the neighbor star at full brightness?"
"Exactly. We had an 1/8 magnitude star where no 1/8 magnitude star ought to be, and the spectrum was that of a red dwarf. You can't see red dwarf stars far away, so it had to be pretty close."
"Yes. But why closer than Alpha Centauri?"
"Naturally, I studied the same area of the sky as seen from Rotor, and the 1/8 magnitude star wasn't there. However, fairly near it was a 1/19 magnitude star that wasn't present in the photograph taken by the far probe. I assumed that the 1/19 magnitude star was the 1/8 magnitude star obscured, and the fact that they weren't exactly in the same place had to be the result of parallactic displacement."
"Yes, I understand about that. A nearby object appears to be in different places against the distant background as one views it from different spots."
"That's right. But the stars are so distant that even if the far probe went out a big fraction of a light year, that change in position wouldn't produce a noticeable shift in distant stars, but it would in nearby stars. And for this neighbor star, it produced a huge shift. I mean, comparatively. I checked the sky for different positions of the far probe on its journey outward. There were 3 photographs taken during those intervals when it was in normal space, and the neighbor star was progressively brighter as the probe viewed it farther and farther toward the edge of the cloud. From the parallactic displacement, the neighbor star turns out to be at a distance of just over 2 light-years. It's at 1/2 the distance of Alpha Centauri."
Pitt looked at her thoughtfully, and in the long silence that followed, she grew restless and uncertain.
"Secretary Pitt," she said, "do you want to see the data now?"
"No," he said. "I'm satisfied with what you've told me. Now, I must ask you some questions. It seems to me, if I understand you correctly, that the chance that someone would concentrate on a 1/19 magnitude star and try to get its parallax and determine its distance is negligible."
"Just about zero."
"Is there any other way of noticing that an obscure star must be very near to us?"
"It may have a large proper motion for a star. I mean that if you watch it steadily, its own motion would change its place in the sky in a more or less straight line."
"Would that be noticed in this case?"
"It might be. But not all stars have a large proper motion. even if they are close to us. They are moving in three dimensions, and we see the proper motion only in a two-dimensional projection. I can explain.
No. I'm continuing to take your word for it. Has this star got a large proper motion?
That would take some time to determine. I do have a few older pictures of that part of the sky, and I could detect an appreciable proper motion. That would need more work.
But do you think it has the kind of proper motion that would force itself on astronomers if they just happened by accident to note the star?
No, I don't.
Then, is it possible that we on Rota are the only ones who know about this neighbor star? Since we're the only ones who have sent out a far probe. This is your field, Dr. Insignia. Do you agree that we're the only ones who have sent out a far probe?
The far probe isn't entirely a secret project, Mr. Secretary. We've accepted experiments from the other settlements and discussed that part of it with everyone, even Earth, which isn't too interested in astronomy these days.
Yes, they leave it to the settlements, which is sensible. But have any other settlements sent out a far probe that they have kept secret?
I doubt that very much, sir. They would need hyper-assistance for that, and we have kept the technique of hyper-assistance entirely secret. If they had hyper-assistance, we'd know. They'd have to perform experiments in space that would give the fact away.
According to the Open Science Agreement, all data obtained by the far probe is to be published generally. Does that mean that you have already informed...
Insignia interrupted indignantly. Of course not. I would have to find out a good deal more before I publish. What I have now is only a preliminary result that I'm telling you in confidence.
But you are not the only astronomer working on the far probe. I presume you've shown the results to the others.
Insignia flushed and looked away. Then she said defensively, No, I haven't. I noticed this datum. I followed it up. I worked out its significance. And I want to make sure I get the credit for it. There's only one star that is nearest to the sun, and I want to be in the annals of science as its discoverer.
There might be a still closer one. And now Pitt permitted himself the first smile of the interview.
It would have been long known. Even my star would be known, but for the very unusual existence of that tiny obscuring cloud. To have another and closer star is quite out of the question.
Then it boils down to this, Dr. Insignia. You and I are the only ones who know of the neighbor star, am I right? No one else?
Yes, sir. Just you and I, so far.
Not just so far. It must remain a secret to us until I am prepared to tell certain specific others.
But the agreement, the open science agreement,
must be ignored. There are always exceptions to everything. Your discovery involves settlement security. If settlement security is involved, we are not required to make the discovery an open one. We don't make hyper-assistance open, do we?
But the existence of the neighbor star has nothing to do with settlement security.
On the contrary, Dr. Insignia, it does. Perhaps you don't realize it, but you have come upon something that can change the destiny of the human species. 5. She stood there, frozen, staring at him. Sit down. We are conspirators, you and I, and we must be friendly. From now on, you are Eugenia to me when we're alone, and I am Janus to you. Insignia demurred.
I don't think that's proper.
It will have to be, Eugenia. We can't conspire on frigid, formal terms.
But I don't want to conspire with anyone about anything, and that's all there is to it. And I don't see the point about keeping secret the facts concerning the neighbor star.
I suppose you are afraid of losing the credit.
Insignia hesitated the merest moment, then said, You can bet your last computer chip I am, Janus. I want my credit.
For the moment, he said, forget that the neighbor star exists. You know that I've been arguing for quite a while that Rota ought to leave the solar system. Where do you stand on that? Would you like to leave the solar system?
She shrugged. I'm not sure. It would be nice to see some astronomical object close up for the first time. But it's a little frightening, too, isn't it?
You mean leaving home?
Yes.
But you wouldn't be leaving home. This is home. Rota. His arm flipped from side to side. It would come with you.
Even so, Mr. Sec... Janus, Rota isn't all there is to home. We have a neighborhood, the other settlements, the planet Earth, the whole solar system.
It's a crowded neighborhood. Eventually, some of us will have to go, whether we want to or not. On Earth, there was once a time when some people had to cross mountain ranges and oceans. 2 centuries ago, people on Earth had to leave their planet for settlements. This is just another step forward in a very old story.
I understand. But there are some people who never went. There are people who are still on Earth. There are people who've lived in one small region of Earth for countless generations.
And you want to be one of these non-movers?
I think my husband Kryl does. He's quite outspoken about your views, Janus.
Well, we have freedom of speech and thought on Rotor, so he can disagree with me if he pleases. Now, here's something else I'd like to ask you. When people generally, on Rotor or elsewhere, think of moving away from the solar system, where do they think of going?
Alpha Centauri, of course. It's the star everyone believes is closest. Even with hyper-assistance, we can't end up going faster than the speed of light on the average, so it would take us 4 years. Anywhere else, it would take much longer, and 4 years is long enough to travel.
Suppose it were possible to travel even faster, and suppose you could reach much farther than Alpha Centauri. Where would you go then?
Insignia paused in thought a while, then said, I suppose... Still Alpha Centauri. It would still be in the old neighborhood. The stars at night would still seem quite the same. That would give us a comfortable feeling. We would be closer to home if we wanted to return. Besides, Alpha Centauri A, which is the largest of the 3-star Alpha Centauri system, is practically a twin of the Sun. Alpha Centauri B is smaller, but not too small. Even if you ignore Alpha Centauri C, a red dwarf, you would still have 2 stars for the price of 1, so to speak, 2 sets of planets.
Suppose a settlement has left for Alpha Centauri and found decent habitability there and settled down to build a new world, and back in the solar system it was known that this had happened. Where would the next settlements go once they decided to leave the solar system?
To Alpha Centauri, of course, said Insignia without hesitation.
So... the human species would tend to go to the obvious place, and if one settlement succeeds, others would follow quickly until the new world was as crowded as the old, until there were many people with many cultures, and eventually many settlements with many ecologies.
Then it will be time to move on to other stars.
But always, Eugenia, success in one place will draw other settlements. A salubrious star, a good planet, will bring others flocking.
I suppose so.
But if we go to a star that is only a little over 2 light-years away, only half the distance of Alpha Centauri, and no one knows about it except us, who will follow us?
No one. Until they find out about the neighbor star.
But that might take a long time. For that long time, they would all flock to Alpha Centauri, or to any of a few other obvious choices. They would never notice a red dwarf star at their doorstep, or if they did notice it, they would dismiss it as unfit for human life, if they didn't know that human beings had already made it a going concern.
Insignia stared at Pitt uncertainly. But what does all this mean? Suppose we go to the neighbor star and no one knows about it. What is the advantage?
The advantage is that we can fill the world. If there is a habitable planet,
there won't be. Not around a red dwarf star.
Then we can use whatever raw material that exists there to build any number of settlements.
You mean there would be more room for us?
Yes. Much more room than if they came flocking in after us.
So we would have a little more time, Janus. Eventually we would fill the room available for us at the neighbor star, even if we were alone, so it would take us 500 years instead of 200. What difference would that make?
All the difference you can imagine, Eugenia. Let the settlements crowd in as they wish, and we will have 1,000 different cultures, bringing with them all the hatreds and misfittings of Earth's dismal history. Give us time to be there alone, and we can build a system of settlements that will be uniform in culture and ecology. It will be a far better situation, less chaotic, less anarchic.
Less interesting, less variegated, less alive.
Not at all. We'll diversify, I'm sure. The different settlements will have their differences, but there will at least be a common base from which those differences will spring. It will be a far better group of settlements for that. And even if I am wrong, surely you see that it's an experiment that must be tried. Why not devote one star to such a reasoned development and see if it works? We can take one star, a red dwarf throwaway that no one would be ordinarily interested in, and use it to see if we can build a new kind of society, and possibly a better one. Let us see what we can do, he went on, if we don't have our energies worn out and broken by useless cultural differences, and our overall biology constantly perverted by alien ecological inroads. Insigna felt herself moved. Even if it didn't work, humanity would have learned something, that this wouldn't work. And if it did work... But then she shook her head. It's a useless dream. The neighbor star will be independently discovered, no matter how we try to keep it secret. But how much of your own discovery, Eugenia, was accidental? Be truthful now. You just happened to notice the star. You just happened to compare it with what you could see on another map. Might you not have missed it altogether, and might not others have missed it under similar circumstances? Insigna did not answer, but the expression on her face was satisfactory to Pitt. His voice had grown softer, almost hypnotic. And if there is a delay of only 100 years, if we are given only 100 years to ourselves to build our new society, we would be large enough and strong enough to protect ourselves and make the others pass by and go on to other worlds. We won't have to hide any longer than that. Again, Insigna did not answer. Pitt said, Have I convinced you? She seemed to shake herself. Not entirely. Then think about it, and I'll ask you just one favor. While you think about it, don't say a word to anyone about the neighbor star, and let me have all the data in connection with it for safekeeping. I won't destroy it. My promise. We will need it if we are going to go to the neighbor star. Will you go that far, at least, Eugenia?
Yes, she said at last, in a small voice. Then she fired up. One thing, though. I must be able to name the star. If I give it a name, then it's my star.
Pitt smiled briefly. What do you want to call it? Insigna's star? Eugenia's star?
No. I'm not that foolish. I want to call it Nemesis.
Nemesis? N-E-M-E-S-I-S?
Yes.
But why?
There was a brief period of speculation back in the late 20th century about the possibility of a neighbor star for the sun. It came to nothing at that time. No neighbor star was found, but it had been referred to as Nemesis in the papers devoted to it. I would like to honor those daring thinkers.
Nemesis? Wasn't there a Greek goddess of that name, an unpleasant one?
The goddess of retribution, of justified revenge, of punishment. It entered the language as a rather flowery word. The computer called it archaic when I checked.
And why would those old-timers have called it Nemesis?
Something to do with the cometary cloud. Apparently Nemesis, in its revolution about the sun, passed through the cloud and induced cosmic strikes that killed off large portions of Earth life every 26 million years.
Pitt looked astonished. Really?
No, not really. The suggestion didn't survive, but I want Nemesis to be the name just the same. And I want it to go on record that I named it.
I promise you that, Eugenia. It's your discovery, and that will enter our records. Eventually, when the rest of humanity discovers the Nemesian region, would that be the right way of putting it? They will then learn who made the discovery and how it came about. Your star, your Nemesis, will be the first star other than the sun itself to shine over a human civilization, and the first, without exception, to shine over a human civilization that originated elsewhere. Pitt watched her leave and felt, on the whole, confident she would fall in line. His letting her name the star was the perfect touch. Surely she would want to go to her own star. Surely she would feel the attraction of building a logical and orderly civilization about her star, one from which civilizations all over the galaxy might descend. And then, just as he might have relaxed in the glow of a golden future, he was shaken by a faint touch of horror that was utterly alien to him. Why Nemesis? Why should it have occurred to her to name it for the goddess of retribution? He was almost weak enough to think of it as an evil omen. Chapter 3. Mother.
6.
It was dinner time, and Insignia was in one of those moods when she was just a little afraid of her own daughter. Those moods had become more pronounced lately, and she didn't know why. Perhaps it was Marlena's increasing tendency to silence, to being withdrawn, to be always seeming to commune with thoughts too deep for speech. And sometimes the uneasy fear in Insignia was mixed with guilt. Guilt because of her lack of motherly patience with the girl. Guilt because of her too great awareness of the girl's physical shortcomings. Marlena certainly didn't have her mother's conventional prettiness or her father's wildly unconventional good looks. Marlena was short and blunt. That was the only word that Insignia could find that exactly fit poor Marlena. And poor, of course. It was the adjective she almost always used in her own mind and could just barely keep out of her speech. Short, blunt, thick without being fat, that was Marlena. Nothing graceful about her. Her hair was dark brown, rather long, and quite straight. Her nose was a little bulbous. Her mouth turned down just a bit at the ends, her chin small, her whole attitude passive and turned in upon itself. There were her eyes, of course. Large and lustrously dark, with meticulous dark eyebrows that curved above them, long eyelashes that looked almost artificial. Still, eyes alone could not make up for everything else, however fascinating they might be at odd moments. Insignia had known since Marlena was 5 that she was unlikely ever to attract a man on the physical plane alone, and that had become more obvious with each year. Oronel had kept a languid eye on her during her preteen years, obviously attracted to her precocious intelligence and her almost luminous understanding. And Marlena had been shy and pleased in his presence, as though dimly realizing that there was something about an object called a boy that was somehow endearing, but not knowing what it might be. In the last couple of years, it seemed to Insignia that Marlena had finally clarified in her mind what boy meant. Her omnivorous reading of books and viewing of films too old for her body, if not her mind, undoubtedly helped her in this, but Oronel had grown older, too, and as his hormones began to exert their sway over him, it was no longer badinage he was in search of. At dinner that night, Insignia asked, "What kind of day did you have, dear?" "A quiet one. Oronel came looking for me, and I suppose he reported to you. I'm sorry you have to take the trouble to hunt me down." Insignia sighed. "But, Marlena, I can't help but think sometimes that you're unhappy, and isn't it natural for me to be concerned about that? You're alone too much." "I like to be alone." "You don't act it. You show no signs of happiness at being alone. There are many people who would like to be friendly, and you would be happier if you allowed them to be. Oronel is your friend." "Was. He's all busy these days with other people. Today that was obvious. It infuriated me. Imagine him getting all wrapped up because he was thinking about Dolorette." Insignia said, "You can't blame Oronel, you know. Dolorette is his age." "Physically," said Marlena. "What a bubblehead." "Physically counts a great deal at his age." "He shows it. It makes a bubblehead out of him, too. The more he slobbers over Dolorette, the emptier his head gets. I can tell." "But he'll keep on getting older, Marlena. And when he's a little older, he might find out what the really important things are. And you'll be getting older, too, you know." Marlena stared at Insignia quizzically. Then she said, "Come on, Mother. You don't believe what you're trying to imply. You don't believe it for a minute." Insignia flushed. It suddenly occurred to her that Marlena wasn't guessing. She knew. But how did she know? Insignia had made her remark as sincerely as she could, had tried to feel it. But Marlena had seen through it without effort. It wasn't the first time, either. Insignia had begun to feel that Marlena weighed the inflections, the hesitations, the motions, and always knew what you didn't want her to know. It must be this quality that made Insignia increasingly frightened of Marlena. You don't want to be glass to another's scornful glance. What had Insignia said, for instance, that had led Marlena to believe the earth was doomed to destruction? That would have to be taken up and discussed. Insignia suddenly felt tired. If she couldn't ever fool Marlena, why try? She said, "Well, let's get down to it, dear. What is it you want?" Marlena said, "I see you really want to know, so I'll tell you. I want to get away." "Get away?" Insignia found herself unable to understand the simple words her daughter had used. "Where is there to get away to?"
"Rotor isn't all there is, Mother."
"Of course not, but it's all there is within more than 2 light years."
No, Mother, that's not so. Less than 2,000 kilometers away is Erythro.
That scarcely counts. You can't live there. There are people living there.
Yes, but under a dome. A group of scientists and engineers live there because they are doing necessary scientific work. The dome is much smaller than Rotor. If you feel cramped here, what will you feel there?
There's a whole world on Erythro outside the dome. Someday, people will spread out and live all over the planet.
Maybe. It's by no means a certain thing.
I'm sure it is a certain thing.
Even if it is, it would take centuries.
But it has to begin. Why can't I be part of the beginning?
Marlena, you're being ridiculous. You've got a very comfortable home here. When did all this start?
Marlena pressed her lips together, then said,
I'm not sure. A few months ago, but it's getting worse. I just can't stand it here on Rotor.
Insignia looked at her daughter, frowning. She thought, she feels she has lost Oronel. She is heartbroken forever. She will leave and punish him by doing so. She will send herself into exile on a barren world, and he will be sorry.
Yes, that line of thought was entirely possible. She remembered when she herself was 15. Hearts are so fragile then that a slight tap will crack them. Teenagers heal quickly, but no 15-year-old would or could believe that at the time.
15. It is later, later that... No use thinking about it. She said,
What is it that attracts you about Erythro, Marlena?
I'm not sure. It's a large world. Isn't it natural to want a large world?
She hesitated before adding the last two words, but she gulped them out somehow.
Like Earth?
Like Earth. Insignia spoke with vehemence. You've never been on Earth. You don't know anything about Earth.
I've seen a great deal about it, Mother. The libraries are full of films about Earth.
Yes, they were. Pitt had felt for some time now that such films ought to be sequestered or even destroyed. He maintained that to break away from the solar system meant to break away. It was wrong to maintain an artificial romanticism about Earth. Insignia had disagreed strongly, but now she suddenly thought that she could see Pitt's point.
She said, Marlena, you can't go by those films. They idealize things. They talk about the long past, for the most part, when things on Earth were better, and even so, it was never as good as they picture things to have been.
Even so?
No, not even so. Do you know what Earth is like? It's an unlivable slum. That's why people have left it to form all the settlements. People went from the large, dreadful world of Earth to small, civilized settlements. No one wants to go in the other direction.
There are billions of people who still live on Earth.
That's what makes it an unlivable slum. Those who are there leave as soon as they can. That's why so many settlements have been built and are so crowded. That's why we left the solar system for here, darling,
Marlena said in a lower voice.
Father was an Earthman. He didn't leave Earth, even though he might have. No, he didn't. He stayed behind.
She frowned, trying to keep her voice level.
Why, Mother?
Come, Marlena. We've talked about this. Many people stayed home. They didn't want to leave a familiar place. Almost every family on Rotor had stay on Earths.
You know that very well.
Do you want to return to Earth? Is that it?
No, Mother, not at all.
Even if you wanted to go, you're over 2 light-years away and you can't go. Surely you understand that.
Of course I understand that. I was just trying to point out that we have another Earth right here. It's Erythro. That's where I want to go. That's where I long to go.
Insignia couldn't stop herself. It was almost with horror that she heard herself say, So you want to break away from me, as your father did?
Marlena flinched, then recovered. She said, Is it really true, Mother, that he broke away from you? Perhaps things might have been different if you had behaved differently.
Then she added quietly, just as though she were announcing that she was done with dinner,
You drove him away, didn't you, Mother?
Chapter 4. Father. 7. Odd, or perhaps stupid, that she was still capable of hurting herself unbearably with thoughts of that kind after 14 years. Kryl was 1.8 meters tall, where on Rotor the average height for men was a bit under 1.7 meters. That alone, as in the case of Janus Pitt, gave him a commanding aura of strength that persisted well after the time when she came to recognize, without ever quite admitting it to herself,
that she could not rely on his strength. He had a craggy face, too, a prominent nose and cheekbones, a strong chin, a look, somehow, of hunger and wildness. Everything about him spoke of strong masculinity. She could almost smell it when she met him, and was struck with fascination at once. Insignia was still a graduate student in astronomy at the time, completing her stint on Earth, looking forward to returning to Rotor so that she could qualify for work on the far probe. She dreamed of the wide advances the far probe would make possible, and never dreamed that she herself would make the most astonishing one. And then she met Kryl, and found herself, to her own confusion, madly in love with an Earthman. An Earthman! Overnight, she felt herself abandoning the far probe in her mind, becoming ready to remain on Earth just to be with him. She could still remember the way he had looked at her in astonishment and said, "Remain here with me? I'd rather come to Rotor with you." She could not have imagined that he would want to abandon his world for her. How Kryl managed to obtain permission to come to Rotor, Insignia did not know and had never found out. The immigration rules were strict, after all. Once any settlement had a sizable population, it clamped down on immigration, first because it could not exceed a certain definite limit on the number of people it could support comfortably, and second, because it made a desperate effort to keep its ecological balance stable. People who came on important business from Earth, or even from other settlements, had to undergo tedious decontamination procedures, a certain degree of isolation, and an enforced departure as soon as possible. Yet here was Kryl from Earth. He complained to her once of the weeks of waiting that had been part of the decontamination, and she was secretly pleased at the way he had persisted. Clearly, he must have wanted her very badly to submit to it. Yet there were times when he seemed withdrawn and inattentive, and she would wonder then what had really driven him to Rotor over such obstacles. Perhaps it was not she, but the need to escape Earth that had been the motivating force. Had he committed a crime? Made a murderous enemy? Fled a woman he had grown tired of? She had never dared ask. And he had never offered information. Even after he had been allowed to enter Rotor, there was a question as to how long he might be able to remain. The Bureau of Immigration would have to grant a special permit to make him a full citizen of Rotor, and that was not ordinarily likely. Insignia had found all the things that made Kryl Fisher unacceptable to Rotorians, additional inducements for fascination. She found that his being Earthborn lent him a difference and a glamour. True Rotorians would be bound to despise him as an alien, citizen or not, but she found even that a source of erotic excitement. She would fight for him and triumph against a hostile world. When he tried to find some sort of work that would enable him to earn money and occupy a niche in the new society, it was she who pointed out to him that if he married a Rotorian woman, Rotorian for three generations, that would be a powerful inducement for the Bureau of Immigration to grant him full citizenship. Kryl seemed surprised at that, as though it hadn't occurred to him, and then pleased. Insignia had found it a little disappointing. It would be much more flattering to be married for the sake of love than for the sake of citizenship, but then she thought to herself, well, if that's what it takes. So, after a typical, long Rotorian engagement, they were married. Life went on without much change. He was not a passionate lover, but he had not been that before the marriage either. He had offered her an absent affection, an occasional warmth that kept her constantly near happiness, if not altogether immersed in it. He was never actively cruel and unkind, and he had given up his world for her and gone through considerable inconvenience to be with her. Surely that might be counted in his favor, and Insignia counted it so. Even as a full citizen, which he had been granted after their marriage, there remained a kernel of dissatisfaction within him. Insignia was aware of this and could not entirely blame him. He might be a full citizen, yet he was still not a native-born Rotorian, and many of the most interesting activities on Rotor were closed to him. She did not know what his training had been, for he never mentioned how much of an education he had had. He didn't sound uneducated, and there was no disgrace in being self-educated, but Insignia knew that on Earth the population did not take higher education as a given, the way that settlement populations did. The thought bothered her. She didn't mind Kryl Fisher being an Earthman and facing down her friends and colleagues where that was concerned.
She didn't know, though, if she could quite handle his being an uneducated Earthman. But no one ever suggested he was, and he listened to the tales of her work on the far probe with patience. She never tested his education by discussing the technical details, of course. Yet sometimes he asked questions or made comments that reflected on such things, and she valued them when they came, for she always managed to convince herself that they were intelligent questions and comments.
Fisher had a job on one of the farms, a perfectly respectable job, even an essential one, but a job that was not high on the social scale. He did not complain or make a fuss about that. She'd give him that. But he never talked about it or showed any pleasure in it, and there was always that air of discontent about him. Insignia learned, therefore, to attempt no cheery, "And what happened to you at work today, Kryl?" The few times she had asked, just at first, the answer had been a flat, "Nothing much." And that would be all, except for a short, annoyed look. Eventually, she grew nervous about talking to him even of petty office politics and annoying errors. That, too, might serve as an unwelcome comparison of her work with his. Insignia had to admit that her fears went against the evidence there, an example of her own insecurity rather than his. Fisher didn't show signs of impatience when she did find herself forced to discuss the day's work. Sometimes he even asked, with a pallid interest, about hyper-assistance, but Insignia knew little or nothing about that. He was interested in Rotorian politics and showed an Earthman's impatience with the smallness of its concerns. She fought with herself not to show displeasure at that. Eventually, there fell a silence between them, broken only by indifferent discussions concerning the films they had viewed, the social engagements they undertook, the small change of life. It didn't lead to active unhappiness. Cake had quickly changed to white bread, but there were worse things than white bread. It even had a small advantage. Working under tight security meant talking to no one about one's work, but how many managed to whisper partial confidences to wife or husband? Insignia had not done so, for she had little in the way of temptation, since her own work required little in the way of security. But when her discovery of the neighbor star was suddenly placed under tight wraps without warning, could she have managed? Surely it would have been the natural thing to do, to tell her husband of the great discovery that was bound to put her name into the astronomy texts for as long as humanity existed. She might have told him even before she told Pitt. She might have come bouncing in, "Guess what, guess what, you'll never guess." But she hadn't. It didn't occur to her that Fisher would be interested. He might talk to others about their work, even to farmers or sheet metal workers, but not to her. So, it was no effort to mention nothing to him of Nemesis. The matter was dead between them, was not missed, did not exist. Until that dreadful day when their marriage came to an end. 8. When did she move over wholeheartedly to Pitt's side? At the start, Insignia had been horrified at the thought of keeping the neighbor star a secret, profoundly uneasy at the prospect of moving away out of the solar system to a destination concerning which they knew nothing but the location. She found it ethically wrong and indecently dishonorable to set about building a new civilization by stealth, one which excluded all the rest of humanity. She had given in on the grounds of settlement security, but she had intended to fight Pitt privately, to bring up points of argument. She had rehearsed them in her own mind till they were foolproof and irrefutable, and then, somehow, she never presented them. Always, always, he took the initiative. Pitt said to her early on, "Now remember, Eugenia, you discovered the companion star more or less by accident, and one of your colleagues may do so as well."
"It's not likely," she began.
"No, Eugenia, we're not going to depend on unlikelihood. We're going to make certain. You're going to see to it that no one looks in that direction, that no one wants to study the particular computer sheets that would give away the location of Nemesis."
"How can I possibly do that?"
"Very easily. I have spoken to the commissioner, and as of now, you are in complete charge of the far probe research."
"But that would mean I've been moved over the head?"
"Yes. It means an advance in responsibility, in pay, in social stature. To which of these do you object?"
"I don't object to any of this," said Insignia, her heart beginning to pound.
"I'm sure you can fulfill the job of chief astronomer more than adequately, but your chief aim will be to see to it
that the work done can be of the highest possible quality and significance, provided that what is done has nothing to do with Nemesis.
But, Janus, you can't keep it completely secret forever.
I don't intend to. Once we move out of the solar system, we will all know where we're going. Till then, as few as possible will know, and those few will learn as late as possible.
Her promotion, Insignia noted with a little shame, cooled her objections. On another occasion, Pitt said to her, "What about your husband?"
"What about my husband?"
Insignia was immediately on the defensive.
"He is an Earthman, I understand."
Insignia's lips pressed together. "He is of Earth origin, but he is a Rotorian citizen."
"I understand. I assume you have told him nothing of Nemesis."
"Absolutely nothing."
"Has this husband of yours ever told you why he left Earth and worked so hard to become a Rotorian citizen?"
"No, he hasn't, and I haven't asked him."
"But don't you ever wonder?"
Insignia hesitated and then told the truth.
"Yes, I have, sometimes."
Pitt smiled. "I should tell you, perhaps."
And he did,
little by little. Never in any overly obtrusive manner. It was never a bludgeon. It was rather the dripping of water at every conversation. It brought her out of her intellectual shell. To live on Rotor, after all, made it entirely too easy to consider only things Rotorian. But thanks to Pitt, to what he told her, to the films he suggested she view, she became aware of Earth and its billions, of its endemic starvation and violence, its drugs and alienation. She began to understand it as an abysmal pit of misery, something to flee from. She did not wonder any longer why Kryl Fisher had left. She wondered why so few Earthmen followed his example. Nor were the settlements so much better off. She became aware of how they closed in on themselves, how people were prevented from moving freely from one to another. No settlement wanted the microscopic flora and fauna of any other. Trade dwindled slowly, and was increasingly carried on by automated vessels with carefully sterilized loads. The settlements quarreled and found each other hateful. The circum-Martian settlements were almost as bad. Only in the asteroid zone were the settlements multiplying freely, and even those were growing suspicious of all the inner settlements. Insignia could feel herself beginning to agree with Pitt, even to grow enthusiastic over a flight from intolerable misery and the beginning of a system of worlds where the seeds of suffering had been eradicated. A new start. A new chance. And then she found that a baby was on the way, and her enthusiasm began to wither. To risk herself and Kryl on the long journey seemed worthwhile. To risk an infant, a child.